Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And I can't drive 55, but I can go to minute 55. We're here in the midst of things. And I know we promised at the end of last episode that Colonel Phillips had started spelling the word Barnes, and he started with B-A-R and was going to end with N-E-S, but we're gonna talk a little bit about it. Hal, why don't you get us up to date on what's going on here?
Right, because, Steve was spelling the name, and then, as you'll see in mere seconds, Colonel Phillips interrupts him before he actually gets to say N-E-S, but we're going to go with it. All right, minute 55. Inside Colonel Phillips' command tent in the Italian camp, the air is thick with tension. Phillips leans back, his face grim. "I can spell," he says sharply. "I have signed more of these condolence letters today than I would care to count. But the name does sound familiar. I'm sorry." Steve Rogers, his jaw tight, presses forward. "What about the others? Are you planning a rescue mission?" Phillips scoffs. "Yes, it's called winning the war." "But if you know where they are, why not at least..." Steve starts, his voice urgent. Phillips cuts him off, his tone hard. "They're 30 miles behind the lines through some of the most heavily fortified territory in Europe. We'd lose more men than we'd save. But I don't expect you to understand that because you're a chorus girl." Steve's eyes flash with resolve. "I think I understand just fine." "Well, then understand it someplace else," Phillips snaps, standing up and walking to a file box. "If I read the posters correctly, you got someplace to be in 30 minutes. Steve looks at a map on the wall, a pin with an H flag on it showing the location of the Hydra base. "Yes, sir, I do," says Steve, leaving the tent. Phillips points at Peggy Carter without looking up from the file box. "If you have something to say right now is..." And we'll find out the rest of that sentence tomorrow.
What an exciting way to cut a sentence in half.
Yes, exactly. Cliffhanger.
Tommy Lee Jones is getting very good, Hal.
Well, it helps to have a sore throat. I don't know why.
Yes. We're going to find
the cadence is so much fun to try to match because, he's not Christopher Walken, but he's kind of in that territory that he's going to say his words to a certain rhythm that isn't how most of us would say it in normal conversation. So trying to figure out what that would be.
When he says, and you mimic this well, when he says, "I have signed more of those condolence letters today than I would care to count." No other actor would have delivered that line like that. Yeah. You did it wonderfully. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's it for me, folks.
Yeah.
I'm leaving on a high note.
Yes, he's waiting for the hard target search to continue. Well, we were, as we did promise last time, we were going to talk a little bit about NES, and the Nintendo Entertainment System is after my time, but my kids did have one. They used to cheat at Duck Hunt. They would get up to the edge of the TV and pull the trigger right in front of the duck. But we're going to talk about some of the old stuff. I did not have a console. I was before consoles and all that. Back when the earth was cooling, the closest I came to it was having a TRS-80 color computer in my house.
Ooh, a color.
Yeah, Coco, they called it.
Yeah, that was something that I certainly lusted after. Absolutely.
Yeah, it was. I used to sell it when I worked for Radio Shack. I sold TRS-80 Model 1s. And sold a surprising amount of them. I was actually surprised I could talk people into taking one home because at the time they were $500. That was $1978.
Right.
But there were people with actual spare cash that would take them home.
Anybody have a VIC 20? Remember the VIC 20?
Remember the VIC 20 of the Commodore 64 very well. I didn't have either one. I desperately wanted those. For me on the computer side, it started with Apple IIs, both at a friend's house first. My friends, the early adopters, and then in elementary school. And then watching some of the other stuff happen, but it was it must have been very, very early 1981. Dad took the plunge and he bought one of the very first IBM PCs at the Sears IBM Business Center.
So yes.
Picks.
Yeah.
Nice.
And and that was like $1,500 or something back then.
Yeah.
And he brought it home and he unboxed it and pointed at it and looked at me and said, "Now teach me how to use it." So
no, wonderful.
that was a powerful thing for me. Yeah.
Games as opposed to computers. But in the early days, of course, there was a fair amount of overlap. I mean,
yeah,
sure. Yeah. And we had a couple of games on it. But I mean, that was the days when I was just talking about this with somebody else, both those early computers and just the early, you know, video games, arcade games, whatever. You know, we are all old enough to know what it feels like to be, you know, among the first people to do something, to push a button or move a slider and see something change on a screen.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's really hard to convey to people now who've grown up and, you know, we're surrounded by screens. I've got two of them on my person right now. But for me, game-wise, you know, I certainly remember seeing Pong in places. I think I have retconned artificial memories into my head where I remember seeing Space Command just because that console was so incredibly cool looking.
Oh, it was ubiquitous.
Yeah. But I don't know if I ever actually saw one. But first thing we got at home, we got a they both came from Sears. We did have a basic Pong set that had two or three games on it. And then we got the Sears Atari 2600 license clone.
Yep.
Played all those cartridges and stuff. So.
Oh, that's neat. That's neat. I didn't know Sears, what, had its own version of it? Or
yeah, there was something. It was just a Sears branded thing. It looked basically identical.
Yeah, it was labeled. I mean, Sears had their own Barbie versions of things. And, and you know, they really were a great major distributor. And I remember that Sears, I think, was the first one to get Space Invaders for the 2600. I mean, I may be wrong on that, but I think they had some unique to Sears games that you could get, but I think they were like the first release of either Pac-Man or Space Invaders on the 2600.
So it was like the Kirkland brand Atari 2600.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It was a white label.
We had it too. My very first video game wasn't a video game at all. It was a text game. It was the Star Trek game.
Star Trek text game, which I know Jim has played.
Apple Trek on the Apple II?
No, I played it at the Lawrence Hall of Science, which was also my first encounter with a big computer. Lawrence Hall of Science is affiliated with UC Berkeley. And when I was in high school, we would take field trips to it. And the field trips were so enchanting. My friends and I would just get on a bus and go visit it once in a while. And they had a big computer room. And I don't remember if I ever saw the computer, but I imagine it being the size of, you know, eight buses behind walls. but they had... you know, basically, tell type's the wrong word, but you know, a keyboard connected to a printer.
The 2741.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the Star Trek game was the early days of gaming was like the early days of radio. It was all theater of the imagination.
Yes.
And it would type out a little grid of here's your quadrant and here's a Klingon ship and here's this and the star. And you would have to calculate the angle to fire a photon torpedo at the Klingons. And, well, that looks like about 25 degrees. And so you'd have to convert it to radians, though. Yes, new radians. And then it would tell you, you hit, time to go to another quadrant. And then you would warp off to another. It's all just text-based characters being printed out. And the suspense was incredible. Like, to find out if you're going to survive this Klingon attack.
Yeah, and you were the E, and you were surrounded by K's.
Surrounded by K's.
Yeah, and you're taking damage, Those torpedoes and phasers are coming in.
It felt like, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I would say my encounter with that was when it was ported to the Apple II, so this would be down the road a ways. So we're on a screen, but it was the same mechanic, same everything else, just seeing these things on a screen. And I remember laughing as a kid. It was the first time, and it stands out, it was like the first time I ever thought about, like, licensing and sort of what's okay and what's not, because at least by the time it was Apple Trek, I was in the E, but I was fighting the Klarnons. Even then that cracked me up, and it's like, is this even okay? But my buddy, a guy named Jim Hogan, and I would go when we had these in sixth grade, you know, we'd wait for the kids to finish playing Lemonade Stand, which was just this ridiculous game. It's like you've got a dollar, you buy some lemons and sugar, and you get a pitcher of water, and you're going to sell it for 5 cents a glass, and then it rains, and you lose your money at the end. So we wait for them to finish so we could go into space and blast Klarnons, and we thought we were pretty darn cool.
Yeah. Catch dysentery.
Then Oregon Trail came along later.
But there are emulators for the Star Trek game. I found maybe in the last two or three years, I found a, you know, a modern version of the same thing. I'm sure you could Google it up and find it. It's just,
oh, sure.
It's delightful because, like I say, it's like an old radio play.
It feels right. Like it feels like you're playing chess with somebody that you have to mail postcards back and forth and just say, you know, the true believers in the Trek game would get, I remember that when in the early days of home computing, you'd get a newspaper or a magazine, mm-hmm. and it would have all the source code
all typed
on
up,
page after page. And the way that you transferred it into your computer, you didn't, your uploads were in your fingers, and you'd just be carefully going, okay, I did line 130, now I got to do line 135, and now I got, and you know, is that an O or a zero?
And maybe when it was all done, you'd draw a hexagon or something.
Yeah. Right.
And I remember that. So I was getting the magazines and I had books of computer games. And there was a point too where, so yeah, you're typing these things, usually at least in basic language. That's how I learned coding in basic, which is the only language I ever really knew. But you would type these things. And I think part of this was just the fact that, okay, that I'm the kid and this is dad's computer. Like I didn't have any floppy disks of my own.
Right.
And these were truly, you know, 5 1/4 floppies when I was around. I did tape drive stuff on the Apple II prior to that.
Yep.
So you'd spend hours and hours and hours typing this thing. And then you'd run it and find all the errors, you know, syntax error in line 110. And you'd have to go through and try to debug it. Then you get it running and then you play it. And then when it was done, okay. Got to turn the computer off and it's gone forever now because I had nothing to save it on. It's like, hey, I'd like to play that game again. Well, I need 4 hours to type and then 20 minutes to play.
Oh, my.
Oh, crazy days indeed.
Yeah.
But you became an expert typist in that time. It just.
Yeah. I mean, that helped a lot. But yeah, that who knew that the typing class I took in high school would be probably the single most used skill throughout my entire life.
I'm with you entirely on that, Hal. I mean, I've written about this before. I took a typing class in summer school and it was a time when, you know, there was still a thought that boys didn't need to learn how to type because they get women to do that for them when they grew up. But I took this typing class and it has served me so well. I think I got my first job as a newspaper reporter because I was the fastest typist who applied.
Just like Clark Kent.
Because I had no other clips. But anyway, we digress. Yeah. We digress from our digression.
One of the things that that bothered me in typing class that affected me in computers was my tendency to forget there was a 1 on the keyboard and I would use a lowercase L when I was typing in numbers for basic lowercase L, there was no 1 key on your.
There was no 1, yeah.
On your typewriter. It's like, there's an extra key up there in the corner. So that's well.
Gosh, I forgot all about that, but you're right. I remember that on the old manual typewriter.
So here's a question as we're dating ourselves. Now, where were you guys when they invented fire? I mean, where do you remember where you were?
On the next cave.
Oh, my God. Yeah. The neighbors were so jealous. We had the only fire pit in the neighborhood.
Brian was going around the neighborhood drawing buffaloes on the cave walls. And
and then suddenly he was able to do it at night because he had a torch. It was incredible.
I like to think that anybody much younger than us who's listening to this, first of all, I know there is nobody who fits that description, but anybody much younger listening to this would kind of appreciate it as oral history.
Right.
Yeah. Gathered around the campfire to listen to the elders tell their stories of Pong.
It just real quick, kind of apropos of not much except video games and Jim, the TRS-80, my dear buddy Craig Williams had a TRS-80, and I think he had a monochrome one. Then I think did he upgrade to color or got the other color version?
Fancy.
And he and I decided we were going to actually write and sell a game. And it was a Donkey Kong knockoff, cleverly called Monkey Kong. And I just hand coded in basic the platforms and the animations and the gorilla would jump up and down, the barrels would roll and stuff. And then we worked together, like we had packaging and everything else. And then we realized that neither one of us had the slightest idea to actually do the coding to make gameplay. But you know, that was a very minor thing. I spent so much time. It's like, oh, my monkey, donkey, gorilla looks just like the real thing. And the barrels are rolling, but I don't know how to like make a player do things and how to keep score and how to do collision detection. Like
you didn't realize that before you started.
No, we were ambitious, Brian. Yeah. It's another word for myopic.
Well, that's how things get
but
done.
We had very nice packaging design too. A Ziploc bag with an insert and
just
disc.
Just needed that the product itself. Yeah. That's the only missing piece.
If we had gone a couple thousand miles or 1,000 miles south, you know, we would have IPO'd in the early days of Silicon Valley and been rich, no matter that we had anything or not.
I had the reverse of that. I used to sit around because I had no money except for I had a computer, but no money. So I'd sit home and make game. I wasn't a good game player, but I liked making games. And I made a game with a friend of mine called Ruski Pow, and it was based on it was similar to a combination of Missile Command and Space Invaders, and you could choose to be the guys flying the planes or the bases on the ground, and the computer would take over whatever the other side was. So if you were flying the planes, you could drop bombs and the computer would be shooting at you, or you could be on the ground shooting at the planes going overhead. And it worked really well, but I had no idea, well, who would buy this? It never occurred to me that I could find somebody who could package it and sell it, and right. You know, there could be money to be made, because it was just, I thought this is just something that everybody who coded stuff would just do things, and then you'd show it to a couple of your friends and then let it go. But
and not too many years after that, had you been in the same set of circumstances, you would have uploaded it to a BBS and released it as shareware. And there's a couple of terms I haven't said out loud in quite a long time.
Well, you had to gain all your credits or so many uploads per download to get things off your BBS.
For those who have no idea what we're talking about, the days of bulletin board systems, which were some of our first encounters with any kind of online experience. And you can kind of think of it sort of like going to different websites, but imagine if every website just had its own phone number.
Yeah.
And, you know, you would get a directory of these things and you'd write the phone number down, or you'd have it in a book and you dial that on your phone and then put your phone in the acoustic cradle in the modem and it would connect. And then you'd look around this site, say, okay, what do they have? And then if you were a little bit, just a little bit risky, like I did, you would one time write a program that the computer would stay up all night dialing sequential phone numbers and then log any one of them when a computer answered.
Oh no. Oh no.
The FBI.
That was after, that was probably that I remember writing that after probably the fifth or sixth time I saw the movie War Games in theater.
So you're trying to cause World War III.
Well, what's a little global thermonuclear war among friends? Yeah. Ryan?
I had an issue back in the 80s where on a bulletin board system where I was working at a job that had Novell networks, and one of the things that I noticed on the if you'll remember the local area networks, Novell was a major player in it, and when they would ship their operating system, they would ship it with a you could type in your username and your password. And it would say your password's good. Sorry, no good. But it never had a count on that. So, and every Novell system shipped with the default name admin. So, you could and typically it would be maybe if you use 6 letters or 8 letters. So you could do a Monte Carlo thing where you say, is it A? Is it B? Is it A? And I wrote a program that you could. You could run on a system and just start asking Novell, is it A, is it B? And I called it NetCrack. And and I had uploaded to a bulletin board system. And it took Novell at least 3 releases before they finally decided, hey, maybe having unlimited logins is not the way to go. But it and I actually solved the problem that I had at my work, because I had to go around and change a bunch of different local area networks so that the flag was turned, maximum of 5 or something. Bad password tries.
I think we just heard Jim's supervillain origin story.
Yes,
I think we did. Yeah.
And then I bought the volcano, and
I thought I was the only one confessing to hacking dalliance as a.
I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure the statute of limitations has run out for us. So,
guys, but, I came up with a way here, I think, to pull our worlds together.
Oh, okay.
We've been talking. I've been. Researching the history of Marvel video games.
Ooh.
And the earliest Captain America video game I can find is called Captain America in the Doom Tube of Dr. Megaloman. 1987, came out for the Atari Amiga, Commodore 64, from a company called Microgen. I've never seen it. I have no idea what it looked like. But then that was 87, followed 2 years later by The Amazing Spider-Man and Captain America and Doctor Doom's Revenge for similar game systems. Marvel's got a really nice stretch of video games here all through the 90s. X-Men, I see a lot of Spider-Man, occasional Captain America popping up, but usually as part of the Avengers.
I'm surprised they waited that long, though. 87 seems... Were there any coin-op machines? It's just kind of surprising that...
I'm not seeing that, but I'm not doing a, you know...
Kind of behind the curve on the licensing thing.
So Capcom has done a whole bunch of, X-Men versus Avengers, or, you know, these sort of street... But they're basically street fighting games.
Yeah.
And, you know, those were coin ops. I'm not sure of the years. I want to say those were probably a little bit later in the 80s, maybe even into the early 90s. They were a little bit after my sort of golden age of arcades and things like that. But, you know, Brian, you've got me thinking. I've got a couple of arcade machines here that have the emulators that have, you know, there's one that has, I think, 13,000 games in it. So now I got to go search. Yeah, I got to go search.
Bring your quarters.
Yes, exactly. Leave them on the desk. But I got to see if... any of those things are in there. One of the, I haven't played many Marvel based games. I've done a little bit of like the Lego Avengers and stuff. And those are pretty fun on either the Xbox Series X or the Nintendo Switch.
I do know one venue that they use heavily, or they used to use heavily, was, casino slot machines. My wife, who, she devotes, many of her vacations to donating money to tribal settlements in the West.
That's good.
Very noble of her.
Yeah. She's usually, pushing little coupons into a machine and then waiting for the coupon to come back with a lower number on it. But anyway, her favorite is the Iron Man, really? Iron Man is this beautiful casino slot machine that has Tony Stark, and if you hit the bonus, he's starts flying around. The repulsor beams are pushing away coins and stuff. So it's now I want to see a Super Mario World, only swap Mario out for Iron Man. It could work. She has a special affinity for Tony Stark Iron Man machines in the casino of her choice.
So another category, right, is coin-op pinball games.
Yes.
And those there's a long history of licensing and things with those. So I'm curious to dig into that a little bit more. I did just do a quick peek for Captain America Pinball, and in the 70s, I remember these kinds of things. I didn't have a Captain America one, but those little just a plastic handheld lap kind of pinball game.
Yeah.
And you've got, your launcher is just a little, springy piece of metal, and you pull the lever on the outside, and then you're trying to get the ball. Usually sometimes you're trying to get it sort of into the holes, but Hasbro did one of those for Captain America, at least as far back as 1976, which is kind of intriguing. But the gameplay looks a little dry, but hey.
Yeah.
The plot, getting back to the movie, the plot of Captain America seems like it would make a great video game.
Well, yeah, you're on a quest. Yeah.
And, you obviously can see where the cut scenes would fit in. And, talking to Colonel Phillips, I have an important mission and you're not allowed to go. And then you can choose yes or no. Go back to the dancing girls, or go 30 miles behind the lines.
What if you just spent the whole game playing it as Steve in the USO show, just because you like
punch Hitler. Yeah.
Right, punch Hitler. It's a bullet in the barrel of your best guy's gun.
Yeah,
I finally got it memorized.
Yeah,
all this kind of stuff.
Pick up the motorcycle. Yeah,
it's interesting. Like, especially in sort of modern times, superhero games kind of in the video game world kind of have a stigma. Like, I don't really recall that in my Microsoft time, we really did much of anything. And so many of them, they come out in conjunction with a movie release or something, and they just end up just not being very good.
Right.
There are notable exceptions. And the first two that come to my mind would be, and that's not necessarily tied to a movie, but, the Batman Arkham series of games are very sort of very moody, very thematic, and deep quest kinds of games. And then the one game that has almost made me buy a PlayStation more than once, and that's Sony's Spider-Man games. Mm-hmm. There's something about the mechanics of the swinging through the buildings. They do it so well and so beautifully. It's so satisfying. Like, even watching a good Spider-Man movie, there's something satisfying is the only word I've got for it. It's just done right, even if it's completely implausible. It feels like the momentum and the movement and everything is exactly what you wish it would be. And the that Sony game really nails it. But I'm always torn in a game like that. Both of those titles I mentioned are great, but they're third person. And I'm always asking myself philosophically versus first person, do I want to be Spider-Man or Batman, or do I want to drive Spider-Man or Batman around the city doing things? And I get it's cool to see the uniform and the costume and stuff, but I tend to gravitate more towards first person stuff.
It seems more like a VR thing would be a first person. I mean, Spider-Man in a VR, like Oculus or something, and where you're swinging your hands and throwing webs.
I have an Oculus and I have the Iron Man game for it.
Oh, really?
And I played it a little bit, and I had to stop playing it because I got such vertigo, I would get nauseous being Iron Man in this suit flying around. And I don't know if it's because the action was so realistic that it actually was like flying around, or if it was just the disconnect between what was going on in my inner ear, what was going on in my eyes, you know, that right. Somehow I think that was it. But I would play this game for 10 minutes as Iron Man flying around repulsoring things. And I had to put it down, and I picked it back up because it just makes me sick to my stomach every time I play it.
I had that effect. I have an Oculus as well, and I had that effect with a Rick and Morty game. There's a Rick and Morty game, and you have to go into their garage and then down into a, you know, this long tunnel, and just I felt like I was falling. I mean, I'm standing in a room, but the motion felt so real, and it has that haptic thing in your hands where you feel like. I mean, you can touch the walls and it bounces back at you. And it's amazing how easy your body is tricked into saying, oh, yeah, this is really happening to me.
Yeah, your body knows it's not. So I think that's the conflict that is not working for me.
And see, now, Brian, all I'm imagining is some sort of gritty Dark Knight Returns kind of thing where virtual world has been waiting for you. You know, you were in there saving the day, and then you mysteriously vanish. You haven't been back in, and everything's kind of going to hell, and there's bad guys waiting to be repulsored.
And
you pull the plug, here comes Brett. I'm getting too old for this, but puts the helmet back on. He goes back in. And,
where have you been?
Yes. You don't know what it's like out there, man, in the real world.
I didn't know time passed for you guys.
Oh, wow.
The story just writes itself.
Yeah, yeah. Brian, you're really, I think, working on Last Mechanical Monster. You need to get that as a VR. I could see clomping around the city in a 60-foot tall mechanical beast would be wonderful.
I could see all kinds of things, but that'd be a lot of fun. And it'd be, the trick about the Last Mechanical Monster, the actual robot, is it was designed by the Fleischer animators, and it is dead easy to draw. It's rectangles and cylinders. And so you could animate the heck out of that thing. It'd be a beautiful piece to put into a game.
Well, if one of our listeners is out there, you know how to contact Brian. Yeah. Wow. Well, somewhere in this, we were going to talk about the movie, but I think we did. This is generally all what's been happening in the film.
Tommy Lee Jones is great. Haley Atwell is great. I think, right.
Chris Evans is great. Bases. And it is another one of those moments, though, where we are seeing Steve's character being reinforced. Yep. You know, he's being told, no, get back in your place.
Is he, though?
Yeah, I think he is.
Phillips is baiting because he turns right around to Peggy at the end there, and he says, "If you have something to say, we're going to find out what he's. You know, if you have something to say,
that's interesting. You
know, I don't think the light has tumbled on for Phillips yet. I don't think he.
Yeah, I didn't read that one with the prisoners.
Okay, I'm feeling that Phillips knows how to yank Steve's chain. And it's like basically he's berating him, so why don't you go back with you're a chorus girl and you're not fit to be in this. So I think he needs to give him the proper motivation. Sometimes it's throwing a hand grenade, sometimes it's just disparaging him.
I think you're being too kind to Phillips.
I'm well, a Tommy Lee fan, but
we're going to pick up this raging debate and this
yes.
violent disagreement on our next episode.
Yes, of course. Wow.
I'm not going to be back. I hate you guys.
Put your helmet on and go save the universe, Brian.
Yeah,
and
I've had enough of this rancor.
The city's being destroyed right now. Well, anyway, thanks everybody for listening and for this episode. If you'd like to continue the conversation, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. If you do like our show, don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our big website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And please be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
Do this all day.